Okay, folks, welcome. You're listening to the latest exciting chapter on the happenings on Planet Pork. It's where it all happens. And of course, where it all happens is usually where Miss Jones is. A very big welcome to you, Leslie Ann. And I'm very interested to hear about your adventures in the last couple of days. You've been out and about around the southeast of England, have you not?
Well, I have, Michael. Good to hear you again.
Thank you.
First of all, I legged it off to Salisbury. Salisbury Cathedral. Yeah. My oldest friend from school has lived there for some years. And in fact, my bedroom in her house, we always call it my bedroom, looks out over the cathedral close.
Oh, right.
And it's the most spectacular view when you wake up in the morning.
Yes.
You know, that cathedral spire there. There's some very interesting sculptures in the cathedral grounds at the moment, mm-hmm. which are well worth going to have a look. There's one amazing thing, which is like a stairway made of light.
Yes.
And it's in front of the spire there, and it looks like a stairway to heaven.
Really?
Yeah,
blimey.
It's fascinating.
Well, that's a good location for you then, isn't it? Stairway to heaven with the obvious connection to the rock chick to a rock band. Yeah, absolutely. Was that where Ted Heath lived?
Yes, right there in that wonderful, covetable house,
yeah.
Which Tim Rice nearly bought that house once.
Did he? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's been restored. Yes, it's back as a museum.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was for sale for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But we did a funny thing on Saturday night. We cooked Christmas dinner.
What?
We cooked Christmas dinner.
What,
we had turkey.
You won't see each other again between now and Christmas?
Yeah, we're not going to see anybody again between now and Christmas,
no.
Are we, the way things are going?
No,
so
no.
Normally we have a little get-together. Our other friend,
yep.
The three of us, the sort of three little kids, three little mates from school.
Yes.
Karen lives in Luxembourg, so she usually comes over for Christmas and we have a Christmas dinner.
Wow.
So because we knew that wasn't going to happen, we did it on Friday night. It was really fun. And we put Christmas pajamas on and put a playlist, Christmas playlist up on. No, when we danced around the kitchen.
All the carols going.
Yeah, not carols, no, Christmas pop songs.
Well, like Here We Are, Merry Christmas Everyone.
All of that, yeah. Mariah Carey, Michael Bublé. Yeah, here he goes.
God.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, it was really fun. And we drank loads of champagne and, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad. It sounds like you had a really nice time. Did you know your friend lives in Luxembourg, does she?
Yeah.
Does she work in the banking industry or does her husband?
She does work in the banking industry.
Yeah.
And she's been there for about 30 years. Her daughter is a student in Florence.
Wow.
She's studying art restoration.
Wow, that's amazing. Because
that's the place to do it.
I don't know if you knew this, but Luxembourg is officially Europe's richest country, even though it's about the size of a football pitch.
And the vast majority of people who work in Luxembourg come in from other countries every day.
Yeah.
They commute in from... You know, all the countries lying around. So then, as I was leaving on Saturday morning to go off down to Sandbanks to stay with a college friend, in fact, my friend stood on the doorstep and said, "Happy Boxing Day," which sent me off with a smile on my
very
face.
Good.
And
yeah,
then Sandbanks, what a place, isn't it? I mean, it's just, I know you're very familiar with
it. I'm very familiar with it, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but it is a fantastic place. You're absolutely right. It's got that sweeping bay, right? You know, really beautiful, sweeping sandy bay. And, of course, some of my family live down in Poole, in Dorset, right, on the sort of Poole-Bournemouth border. And they go there all the time. My niece is an open water swimmer, right? And she often swims right across Sandbank Bay, you know, Sandbanks Bay, because the water's lovely and clear and everything. And, of course, the great and the good all live there.
They do. And we saw all those swimmers out there. They're mad, these people. Yesterday morning, all just jumping in the sea in normal swimsuits, not even wetsuits and stuff.
Yeah.
And then they come crawling out the sea and they rush for these big sort of towel cloaks that they
just
put on to stop themselves being cold.
And
paddle boarders as well. There were lots of those.
Uh-huh.
And outside the Sandbanks Hotel, they were having yoga classes on the sand.
Golly. We go to the Sandbanks Hotel every Boxing Day. I go down and stay with my sister, and then, you know, it's all done at home on Christmas Day, as you were talking about Christmas Day. And then to give all the cooks and people a break, we go off to the Sandbanks Hotel on Boxing Day for lunch. So it's very nice. And, of course, when I say the great and the good live there, you will have, well, you may have, if you'd got up early enough, bumped into Harry Redknapp walking his dog.
Well, they live a couple of doors down from my friend. Really? So we did go past his house. And
It's in a little close of three houses, isn't it?
No, it's a little stretch. He's recently sold that house. He's had three houses down there now, I believe.
Oh, well, I knew his first one. That went down to the water. And I used to drive around sometimes early in sandbags. I'd see Harry. He'd be walking his dog. Sanya, and go back for a cup of coffee or something like that. But then he downsized. And the last time I was around there and saw him, his house was in a little close of three houses, if you see what I mean.
You've seen those two houses, huge big houses that are identical.
Yes.
And they were built about 6 years ago. And my friend told me that they have been on the market for 6 years.
Right.
They have sold. They're £6.5 million each.
Yes.
Now, how can that developer afford for them not to be sold?
Well, because the value of them holds or goes up all the time. So it's an appreciable asset, if you see what I mean. So if he's borrowed the money from the bank to buy them, it doesn't really matter because interest rates are so low now, it doesn't matter. But it is one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the world, Sandbanks. It really is. And over the years, I don't know if they're still there, but Graeme Souness has lived there, Jeffrey Boycott lived there. And of course, and Mimi lived there. How did John Lennon find Sandbanks all those years ago when it wasn't fashionable?
Well, she just said she wanted to move south because she was sick and tired of being fans at the door all the time in Liverpool, in Walton, where she lived.
Yeah.
And she couldn't stand it anymore. She was getting too old. And she said she would like to move down south. And she and John just went house hunting. Mm. And they found this little bungalow. It was quite modest.
Yes.
Harbour's Edge, it was called. And it had lovely stone steps going right down to the water. Yeah. And I think John bought it primarily for himself.
Right.
Because he did used to visit Mimi quite often there.
Right.
And it was his escape from all the madness that was going on during the Beatle years.
Sure.
And he would just go down there. He took Yoko down there a few times.
Yeah. So,
and she had a neighbour who had a rowing boat. There's a river nearby. I don't know the name of
it.
He kept this rowing boat on a little river, and John used to borrow the rowing boat and go up and down the river. And it is said that that's where he pulled the line, picture yourself in a boat on a river from Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with marmalade trees and tangerine skies.
Or maybe even the other way around.
Exactly.
But they talk about Sandbanks as being the UK's Palm Beach. I would have said it's much more like Malibu.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I mean, there's no palm trees there, and it's very flat. And the houses are not very tall. There's a one or two towers related to the hotels, but generally speaking, pretty flat. And it's just a beautiful view out, isn't it, to the sea? And
it's fantastic, but very eerie waking up to those huge department store sized cruise ships.
Oh yeah,
which are obviously anchored out in the bay.
Absolutely.
And at night, the lights come on. Mm. And it's so spooky because you know that there's nobody on apart from probably a couple of members of staff or something.
Yeah, no,
just to keep them safe.
Yeah.
But you know, down by the Haven Hotel and Spa,
went
walked down there. I didn't know this. Marconi conducted the first wireless experiments in that very building in the late 1890s.
Yes, apparently, yes. There's a plaque there, actually, which commemorates it, but... there you go. So Sandbanks famous for all sorts of reasons. Now, we talk about family show and all that sort of thing, Miss Jones. But I have to say, there's a columnist lady. So she's in the same profession as you. She's a scribe called Camilla Long, and she writes pieces in the Sunday Times. Okay. And I have to say, she's written a piece about this situation regarding Dominic West and the actress. What's her name? Lily somebody.
Lily James, who's the star of Mamma Mia.
That's right. And we're going to have to apologise because this is a family show. But she says, for many posh men, playing away is part of the deal and their wives surely know it. And then she goes on to say, this is great. You can spot the old Etonian shagger a mile off. So presumably Dominic West is an old Etonian, right? Bibulous, giggly, prone to fondling, honking, and party tricks, such as standing close to female guests sitting at a table and quietly laying their private parts on their shoulder. She didn't use the word private parts either. When I...
What, she said the actual thing, the bit?
Yeah, the bit beginning with the letter P.
Oh,
yes.
God, how gross.
She's making out, she's seen that happen, you know, amongst these Etonian...
Well, I bet that's not true. I've never seen anyone do that. And I've been to a few of these dinner parties in my time.
I should...
I've not seen that. I told you what I did see.
What was that?
Somebody take that out when the girl went to the toilet and put it in her glass of champagne.
No, no, no. Sorry. Family shows. I mean,
family show.
I mean, you know, you're giving me a salacious story now. I'm reading from fact, so I'm excused because it's actual.
Well, it's not really fact, is it? It's a columnist writing whatever she wants to write. So
it's verbatim from a print. That's what I'm saying.
Okay? Yeah, go on. I'll give you that.
And she goes on to say, when she interviewed West, he spoke about his dark urges. And she says clearly his dark urges were that he had it on his mind all the time that he was going to start trying to find some other women to screw apart from his wife, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It confirmed my suspicion that he was a serious flirt and there was truth in all the stories. She says, at that point, everyone in West London had a Dominic West sex story. He had a reputation as an extraordinary lover, a truly transformative shag, according to one woman I spoke to. Very flexible and enthusiastic and energetic. I think we've got too much information there, haven't we?
Is this Penthouse you're reading from?
No, it's honestly, it's Camilla Long, the columnist.
The Sunday Times. Well, I think I'm disgusted that they've actually printed that piece.
Really?
Because that is sensationalism. Nobody knows that for sure.
Well, she's interviewed him and you know, some time ago, years ago, she's interviewed him. He's a star of everything.
Yeah, but he hasn't described himself as a transformative shag.
No, but what she's saying is she's spoken to people in his set who've described him as a transformative shag. So
Would you describe yourself as a transformative shag?
To me?
Yeah, you.
Well, I have transformed a few women's lives, but I don't think it's been the actual, you know, act of shagging.
Was it truly transformative?
No, I normally try to transform ladies' lives by being a gentleman, you know, buying champagne and taking nice restaurants and, you know, buying them gifts and that kind of stuff. You know, I think that's
infinitely preferable. I like your style.
Exactly. But anyway, look, I mean, you know, it takes a lot to shock me. But when I read that piece, I thought, oh, my God, can't read too much more of this. She actually compares him to David Cameron, because David Cameron, of course, is an Etonian as well.
There is a type, isn't there? And these men tend to be all mouth and not much in the trousers, if you know what I mean.
Well, she says, if you don't have the urge to shag around and you're an Etonian, no one wants to look as if they're still actually having sex with their wife like David Cameron.
Oh, dear. Well, we know they did because they had a child while they were in number 10.
Absolutely. Anyway, look, enough of that because that is really salacious stuff. But listen, let's not get away from showbiz because, again, one of our favourite sort of hate figures, for want of a better word, or certainly in my case, is old Hugh Grant, the man who hates the press because we exposed him as being a man who uses prostitutes in his car in L.A., but this is an amazing story. A child actress from Love Actually, that's obviously the famous film that followed Four Weddings and a Funeral, in which Hugh Grant starred. A child actress from Love Actually claims the movie star Hugh Grant refused to speak to her, Lulu Popplewell, who branded the rom-com cheesy, a word that I can't use, and sexist.
Beginning with S and ending with T.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And sexist was introduced to him by writer Richard Curtis, who obviously wrote the film. She said, I remember meeting Hugh and he said, oh, God, do I have to speak to her? I hate children. I mean...
Said the father of five. The
father of five children. Every time I read something about Hugh Grant, I'm afraid my lack of admiration for him increases. Now
he's deeply unpleasant, isn't he? I mean,
you know young Lulu Popplewell, don't you?
Yes, I do. I've known Lulu since she was a very little girl, because her family are members of the St. Bride's Church congregation. Oh. Her father is a judge, Sir Andrew Popplewell.
Here come the judge.
In the Court of Appeal. He's, in fact, the son of Sir Oliver Popplewell, who was a very big noise in the judiciary when we were on Fleet Street.
The hanging judge. Yeah, I remember
That's one. Yeah. And her mother is Dr. Deborah Lomas, who is a dermatologist. Mm. And illustrious sister, who was the star of Anna, that is, the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh.
And their little brother Freddie was in Peter Pan. So they've had quite a thespian experience, that family. Really. Right. They're delightful people, I've got to say.
Yeah.
Lulu goes her own way. Mm-hmm. She's very feisty. Yeah. She's a bit of a piano banger, if you know what I mean. You could picture Lulu in an East End pub,
a piano,
sort of banging out the tunes. Really? And she's she's a bit of a comedian as well, right, these days.
Okay.
But she tells it as it is. Right. She doesn't hold back.
Right. Okay.
So I'm not surprised to hear her saying this.
Yes, exactly. When you speak out publicly against a guy like Hugh Grant, there's always the danger of a backlash from the lovely community, isn't there?
Not only that, but I mean, Richard Curtis, who you mentioned, who created the film, you then turn around and say his film is effectively rubbish.
Yeah.
Isn't that biting the hand that feeds?
Yeah, I suppose it is, yeah.
You're not going to get cast again, are you?
No, but I think she was talking more about her experience than the film. Oh, no, she does say the film was dreadful. You're right, yeah. Yeah, I think that's very wrong.
Looking back, it was rather sexist, and the women in that picture were sort of playthings for men.
They were
usable, you know, and I think we've moved on from those days.
I thought it was a rubbish film anyway, because I thought Hugh Grant was completely miscast. I mean, look at the Prime Minister we've got now. You know, the words buffoon and excitable and, you know, unpredictable could be used to him. But Hugh Grant was such an unlikely character as a single man, as a prime minister. No bloke as good looking as him who'd risen to the top of politics would have been single, would they?
Well, don't you think he was rather like David Cameron?
I suppose so, but David Cameron was much smoother and married and family. Politicians, usually, to become prime ministers, have to have a family around them. Ted Heath was the obvious exception, but that's because the Tories were in such a state of, you know, ruin and decay. They had nobody else to turn to. But anyway, look, we shouldn't be getting too political. Now, I've got a huge dilemma here, Miss Jones. You're going to have to help me out with my conscience, OK?
Come on.
You, of course, know an awful lot about football because your Uncle Cliff was a member of the Spurs double-winning team of the early 60s, and you've mixed with footballers all your life. Your father, the legendary Ken Jones, used to have them around for Sunday lunch when you were there and all that. But sometimes you've got to go against your own club. Now, what happened yesterday when you were gallivanting around on the South Coast? I'm sorry, it was last Saturday, wasn't it? Yesterday, we're not talking about last Saturday. Everton played Liverpool, and in the early minutes of the game, the Everton goalkeeper Jordan Pickford comes running out of it off his line and clatters into Virgil van Dijk, who is Liverpool centre half and probably the finest defender in the world at the moment. Liverpool are world champions anyway. And clattered into him in the area, brought him down. It was obvious that Van Dijk was injured. You know, he sat on the ground, hands spread behind him, wincing in pain. It now transpires he's got the worst injury a footballer can have, the anterior cruciate ligament damage, which means that he's out for at least a year. And Pickford, our goalkeeper, the Everton goalkeeper, didn't even get booked for it, let alone sent off. I feel dreadful for poor Virgil van Dijk, and I haven't yet put out anything on Twitter expressing my view on it, and I feel a bit rotten about myself.
You should, yeah, because, yes, Everton are your team, but also, yes, Jordan Pickford did destroy this guy for the next year.
Yeah.
And I know that they decided that he shouldn't be sent off for it, but he probably should have. You know, that anterior cruciate ligament injury, it's one of the most common knee injuries, of course.
Yeah.
It mostly requires reconstructive surgery, so he is out for a long time.
Yeah.
My son had that surgery because he was injured in rugby, playing rugby at school, and then went on to musical theatre college and obviously needs his knees for dancing.
Yes, sure.
But I've got a feeling you don't ever really recover from it.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's very rare for a player to come back as good as he was. It finished off Paul Gascoigne, for instance. Gascoigne went mad in the cup final in 91. And it was a self-inflicted injury. He lunged at a Nottingham Forest player, overstretched himself, crashed into the player and buckled his leg. Because what the ACL does is it stops your leg bending backwards. Do you see what I mean? You've got a knee joint and it stops it from bending backwards. It only bends forward, so to speak. And, of course, Gascoigne had been sold at the time for £5 million to Lazio in Italy. That transfer was delayed by a year. But Gascoigne was never the same footballer again. Never.
No, it is a shame. But did you see he put out, Van Dijk put out a rather lovely thing on Twitter, a nice message.
Yes, I did.
And he said, in football, as in life, I believe everything happens for a reason.
Yes.
It's important to try and keep level-headed about going through these things. Mm. And then he praised his wife, children and family for supporting him. So, you know, he seems to be keeping on a good psychological track, at least.
Yeah, he will. That's quite philosophical. But wait until he's 8 months into it. That's when it really,
That's
when it really crunches. A good friend of mine, Premiership footballer Joe Cole, had exactly the same one. And Joe said that the training, once you've got that, is the toughest training you've ever had. A, you have to train on your own because managers don't want injured footballers around with the squad, okay? B, it's intense training. I mean, you could spend 10 hours a day in a swimming pool just cycling on an imaginary bike to get your knee joint back. You know what I mean? Although it's very lonely. It's very, very hard. And he's got a terrible 12 months in front of him, even if he can come back. And you know, it's a terrible thing because he is a top player at the moment. If it had happened to your uncle in 1961, he probably would never have played again.
That would have been it, yes. My father was injured out of the game. He was a professional footballer and he snapped his Achilles tendon.
Oh, got it.
And in those days, that was it.
That's right. It rolls up the back of your leg and it's gone, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, dear me, terrible. Right. Okay. Well, look, you know, let's hope that some respite comes of it. But I do feel terrible about it. I've got a moral dilemma here. I'm going to have to make up my mind. Somebody's going to ask me, you know, come on, Porky, what do you think about this? You know, and I'm going to have to say something. Now, is this the least surprising survey you've ever read of? Researchers by the Marriage Foundation has found that the divorce rate among celebrity couples is 67% higher than other couples in the early years of marriage. And they cite one example of Britney Spears, who divorced her husband 55 hours after saying "I do" in their wedding ceremony. I thought we all knew that the celebrity marriages were as fickle as can be.
Well, yeah, obviously. I think it's because what they do blurs the lines, doesn't it, between fantasy and reality. So you're not really sure if you're getting that person or not, or whether you're getting the public version of them.
Yeah.
So then you've got things like big age gaps, which tend to happen if rock and pop stars marry younger women.
Yeah.
Then you've got all the excessive tabloid and media attention.
Yes.
But there are some success stories. You'd have to say David Beckham and Victoria, wouldn't you?
Oh, definitely.
Who weathered the rumours of infidelity in 2004, and they're still together 16 years later.
Yeah.
So they obviously had a healthy relationship to start
with. Yes.
But I think it's also to do with clashing schedules, far-flung locations.
Yes.
You know, these long separations can be very taxing on a couple.
Yes.
And that also the thing where you have one is a celebrity and the other one isn't in a couple. And as the Americans would say, there's no commonality in that relationship.
No commonality.
It doesn't stand much chance, does it?
Well, do you know what? I think sometimes it's worse when they're two big stars. Because take Tom Cruise and who was the first one he was married to?
Nicole Kidman.
I mean, apparently one of the big problems there, apart from other rumoured problems within the relationship, was that they were constantly battling each other's egos against each other. Who's got the better film? Who's got the biggest paycheck? You know, who's the biggest star in Hollywood and all that kind of stuff.
And the other aspect of it is that such relationships tend to be a bit 0 to 60, don't they? So they go too fast. They don't develop at a normal rate as, say, a regular relationship in our world would tend to, because of all the media attention again.
Yeah.
So it tends to go from nothing to, you know, passionate love, got to get married, and they haven't really thought it through.
Yeah, and some of them start as publicity stunts, and then they suddenly find, oh, we've fallen in love, but then 10 weeks later, they find it was actually a publicity stunt after all. You know what I mean?
Going back to Lily James and Dominic West, I feel very sorry for her. She's 31.
Yeah.
You know, she was in a relationship for 5 years with Doctor Who, Matt Smith, wasn't she?
Sure, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's very sweet.
He's now married to Peter Davison's daughter, isn't he?
Doctor Who person, but I think she's been a bit used here.
Yeah.
And it's all very well to say we all feel sorry for the wife, but, you know, he could have spun her any kind of line, couldn't he?
Yes.
Oh, my wife doesn't understand me. That's the usual one. Or we're on a break or, you know, anything. I'm leaving my wife. It's just the kids I have to sort out.
What?
So she's now there cancelling publicity engagements and so on because she's too embarrassed to come outside the house.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And yet the real wife of Dominic West stands at the gate and, look, we're all okay, issues a statement, a written statement, saying our marriage is fine. But as Camilla Long says, we referred to half an hour ago, no, not half an hour ago, about 15 minutes ago.
About 3 weeks ago.
She says, oh, well, these Eton men, they you know, they take it for granted they can have a mistress, and many of their wives just accept it. So,
well, that's all very well for the wife. Yeah. If she's happy with that, fine. Yeah. But it doesn't seem to me to be very fair on the young girl.
No, I totally agree. Right, OK, kids, thank you. Sorry, kids, what am I saying about it? I'm assuming that we've got a very young audience. Of course, we have got many members of our audience who are young, but we then have those who are entering early middle age. We have mature followers. Something for everybody in Planet Porky. Would you not agree, Miss Joan?
Absolutely, yes. And very happy to have them all along.
Of course, we certainly are. Now, I tell you who is really amusing me at the moment, and I do love her. It's Melanie Sykes, right? Have you seen Melanie Sykes's latest adventures? She's gone off to Venice and apparently had this amazing affair with a 23-year-old gondolier. Melanie is 50, and of course, Melanie is famous for the Boddington's beer advert, isn't she? You know.
Quite a long time ago. Yeah, she's done various things since then, including Radio 2 with Alan Carr, which is quite listenable to, actually.
Yes.
Somebody described us, you and I, as the Melanie Sykes and Alan Carr of podcasts.
Really? Oh, well.
Recently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment, whichever way.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
That's good. So what do you make of Miss Sykes at 50? And listen, the other thing is, you know more about this than I do. She runs off to Venice. She has this affair, according to the report, with a 23-year-old gondolier. The pictures are so intimate, they are past the sick bag Alice stuff. You know, her arms wrapped around this gondolier, you know.
Wrapped around his what?
Wrapped around this gondolier.
Oh, I thought you said wrapped around his gondolier. Oh, there's a new one.
Come on, Miss.
Family show, you know, come on.
I suppose you're going to tell me now, oh, well, you know, those gondoliers, they have a big thing at the back of the boat and all this.
a big curly thing at the back of the boat.
The back of the boat. But what I'm saying is, they're so public, it must be a publicity stunt, mustn't it?
It's got to be. You've seen him. He looks bandbox fresh. That doesn't even look like a real gondolier's
outfit.
He's
not a gondolier. You're absolutely right. He looks like a model.
Perhaps they're making a film or something. He's 23. This is the bit about it that worries me. She's a mother of two sons, two boys, age 18 and 16. Yes. Not a million miles from 23.
Exactly. Yeah, I know.
She does look a bit sheepish in the sort of post-trip pictures, got to say.
She? Yeah.
Yeah, she's sort of crept out with sunglasses on and, you know, eyes to the ground and all of that. Yeah. But I'm sure there's more to this.
I'm sure it must be because, look, we all know that people have arrangements with paparazzi. That lady who used to be the baker's mistress, you know, Summer, I think her first name is, okay?
Oh, Paul Hollywood, you mean? Yeah.
I mean, she clearly...
You're always banging on about her. You've got a thing about her, haven't you?
The thing I've got about her is that I admire people who, with minimum of talent, make the maximum of their lives, you know what I mean? And what she does is once a week is wear a boob tube and just ring up... I mean, the name of the agency that takes them is on every picture, Splash, OK? So she puts a boob tube on once a week, rings up Splash and says, oh, I think I'll go down to my local pub, or, oh, I'm going to be in Kensington or something like that, you know what I mean? Which is good luck to her, that's fine. But this...
So shall we do that? Shall we put boob tubes on and go out and see what we can get?
Well, you could put a boob tube on. I would...
So could you?
I'd be rather more sophisticated than that. But what I'm saying is, it was almost like... They're almost like advertorial pictures for a movie or something. You're so right. Yeah, you've got it right, definitely. I think you're right. Tell me what you think about Martina Navratilova, who is 64 today.
Oh, well, happy birthday to her, first of all. I think she's amazing. She has, you know, she came out as a gay woman at a time when that was a very risky thing to do.
I agree.
And I think she's not only been...
Sorry to interrupt. Can you remember, had Billie Jean King come out by then?
I don't think she had, because there were rumours. My dad used to say, oh, well, you know, look at her. She's a lesbian on television. Yeah. And I'd say, Dad, you can't say things like that, you know. Yes. But obviously she was. And the circuit, the tennis circuit, was always rife with rumours about that kind of thing and older women players preying on younger tennis players and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, she has turned out to be a real pioneer, hasn't she? Yeah. And the thing she speaks up about lately is a very controversial subject, which is to do with male athletes becoming female and then competing against biological women. Yes. Her view is that they are still biologically men, yes, which is very controversial and which we can't say.
Well, she gets a lot of opposition to that because in the world of woke, you're not allowed to question the sexuality of somebody who has self-defined their own sexuality. And the other person who is very, very strong on this is the lady swimmer, Sharon, what's her name?
Sharon Davis,
very strong on it. I've been on TV shows where she's come on and talked about it, and she knows all about, you know, the biological makeup of the X chromosome and the Y chromosome and all that. And she's very strong on it. But you're right, she gets an awful lot of, you know, sort of hate mailed stuff whenever she speaks about it.
And it's just exactly what J.K. Rowling has been through.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
For speaking about people with wombs and so on.
Yeah.
You know, Martina says that a trans athlete competing against a woman is insane,
yeah,
and that it's cheating. But we're not allowed to say that anymore because the woke generation do,
yeah,
not agree.
That's right. Is it?
There's something wrong with society if we can't say what we think.
That's right. I think, is it Martina Navratilova who said, look, she said the 300th best male player in the world would still beat the woman's Wimbledon champion because of the biological makeup of men and women. And that,
yes, absolutely, yeah, because of the strength, yeah, exactly, the muscular, yeah, strength, yeah, of those, yeah, people and so on. It's like you couldn't race against them either.
No, exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. I tell you,
I don't know where this one goes.
What do you mean?
This argument. I don't know how they resolve
it. No, I don't know how to resolve it unless people suddenly, you know, inherit common sense again, which has gone out the window, you know, like in the last couple of years. I don't know if it'll ever come back. One hopes it will. But Martina Navratilova, before she came out, I was working in America, right, and I got a call from the news desk, and they said, and Martina Navratilova, I think she was still Wimbledon champion. If she wasn't, it was a year or two after she, 84, would she have been? She might have been. Anyway, look, the point is, they rang me and they said, you know Martina Navratilova's in the country, don't you? I said, is she? They said, yeah, of course, it's Wimbledon next week, and this week it's the women's warm-up grass tournament in... Is that in Brighton or somewhere on the coast, Hove or somewhere like that? Okay. So
yeah,
they said, look, you know, all these rumors, you know, flashing around about her private life and all that, you know, do a bit of digging around in New York and see what you can find out. And I said, have you sent anybody to talk to her? You know, most obvious thing. No, wouldn't get anywhere near her, mate. Wouldn't get anywhere near her. So I rang the hotel in Brighton and got through to her room and spoke to her. And she actually said to me, Mr. Parry, she said, I don't ask you who you sleep with, so please don't ask me about my private life. She's very polite and all that, but quite amazed to get a call from me, Daily Express reporter in New York, when the head offices were 100 miles up the road in London. But anyway, just a story to glorify my great career as a newspaper reporter, Miss Jones. I'm sure you'd agree.
Well, the thing is, yes, you were great, and you still are great. We have to be fearless doing the job that we do,
yeah,
and not to take no for an answer.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. What do you think, talking about women who've stood up for them, what do you think about Jilly Cooper? Because she's 83 now and she's got a new book out, and the new book is a sort of rehashed account of some of the columns she's written for newspapers over the years. But even reading her promotion for it, it's 83, she's still banging on about sex, you know. And I have to say, I find that little, you know, difficult to sort of feel comfortable with, you know what I mean?
A bit tough to swallow.
Excuse me.
Family.
Another double entendre, honestly. You know, what I'm talking about is, you know, the thought of 83-year-old people having sex, actually, I find quite difficult to understand.
I can hear you squirming. Mm. I have to agree with
you.
Right. There was some talk about her republishing her diaries. What I read was that she's told her children,
yeah,
to destroy the diaries when she dies so that they never get published.
Really?
In which case, why not have a bonfire now?
Yes, exactly. Yes, good idea. Why does she want them destroyed after she's died? Did she explain that one?
Well, just she doesn't want them out there. She doesn't want people reading her intimate secrets, which is a bit rich, isn't it, when she writes the kind of stuff she writes?
Yeah, I've been here for 50 years, so I find that one a bit difficult, I have to say.
I don't really want an old lady banging on about sex in public. I think there comes a time to hang up your G-string.
Yeah, oh, yes. Oh, God, I thought of an 83-year-old woman in a G-string, please. It's getting worse. It's getting worse. Good job.
Oh, I have to lie down.
Good job, I had my breakfast. tell me this, Miss Jones. Now, you're the mother of two daughters, okay?
Yes.
And a lady we spoke to before, but for different reasons, Dawn French, says, and I have to say, I'm not a parent, but I understand what she's saying, why mums should not be friends with their daughters. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I've got a number of friends who have forged these sort of quite intense, intimate relationships with their daughters, and they go out as best friends, and they talk five times a day on the phone, all that kind of thing. I don't believe it's possible. I think your kids, however old they get, they need a mother. They don't need a best friend. They got plenty of those, and they talk to them on a different level, but they need a mum. They need someone to come to when things go wrong. Someone to come home who's going to cook them a dinner and, you know, make up a nice clean bed and put them to bed when it's all gone over the side. I don't think our job, our role, is to be their best friend.
No, I totally agree. And also, you've got to admonish them when they go wrong. You've got to be fearless in trying to correct their behaviour if you think it's wrong, for the sake of their future of their life. And you can't.
Absolutely.
It's more difficult to admonish somebody if you're trying to be their best friend. The biggest example I ever saw of it was Fergie, you know, Duchess Fergie,
Sarah Ferguson,
that's right, yeah. And I saw a picture of her in a paper, and she was dressed up, you know, like a trollop, you know what I mean, a very flowery sort of dress.
As she normally looks, in other words.
Right, yeah. And I'm not being rude to her, that's her dress style, you know. And standing next to one of her daughters, Beatrice or Eugenie, and giving a chat about, oh, no, we go out on the pool together, you know, we're like best friends. And I thought, what a dreadful example to set to your daughter. And you know, I most women that I've, you know, sort of come across in my life always have always said to me, I prefer my mum to, you know, smell of polish and to be standing behind an ironing board rather than trying to impress me that they, you know, are my equal in social standing.
Well, that's going a bit far. I do not smell of polish.
Yeah.
And I do not stand behind an ironing board most of the time. Right. But you know, it has been known on occasion, but I try never to iron anything anymore because I've got better things to do with my time.
Pretty
but
good.
I think Fergie was always going that way. She was never going to be a good example to her children, was she? I mean, seen some of this...
Hardly, if she's getting her toes sucked by some bald-headed American while she's on a sunbed in the south of France when she's still married to the Duke of York, that's hardly an example, is it?
I know, that was tragic. And she already had children by then, of course. And I think, you know, some of the recent footage of Fergie and Andrew's engagement and their marriage and those horrible tours that they went on when she really did act up and she was so graceless and gauche and attention-seeking and entitled. And I just wish she'd go away.
Yeah, I kind of do as well. Now, there was a documentary the last couple of nights on Channel 5, which I think's turning out to be a great channel, really, Channel 5. I know you're not a TV watcher, but...
I do a lot of work for Channel 5, actually, so I'm fully in favour.
Yeah, I do as well, actually, but that's not the reason why I thought it is. The guy who runs it is a guy called Ben Frow, and he's pioneered things like The Return of All Creatures Great and Small and...
Very successful, that's been
yeah,
as well.
And all kinds of things like that. But anyway, I haven't had a chance to see this documentary yet because I was working late that day. But it's Beatrice and Eugenie, and it's narrated by, it says in the synopsis, narrated by their friend, Lizzie Cundy. Now, I know Lizzie very well. You know, I've done shows with Lizzie, and I work at the same radio station as her, so I see her there and all that. And I had no idea that Lizzie was a friend of Beatrice and Eugenie, but she will have done a very good job, Lizzie. She's known as sort of Queen Wag because she was married to Jason Cundy, you know, professional footballer, who now is a broadcaster himself. But what I'm thinking is they really didn't have a chance in life having two parents who have so badly gone off the rails. You'd almost be embarrassed to admit who your parents are, wouldn't you, if you were either one of those two girls?
Totally, totally. I think I would have gone off and lived in another country and severed my contacts and tried to build a new life.
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, because everywhere they go now, particularly since the Duke of York is so completely discredited that he's virtually been thrown out of the royal family and erased from the royal chronicles, if you see what I mean, how on earth can they show their face anywhere when, you know, any minute now, they might get a question about, oh, your dad, oh, he's the friend of that paedophile who killed himself, isn't he? I mean, it's shocking, yeah, isn't it?
It's that smell is never going away, is it? So I wonder what he will do with the rest of his life, because what is he, about 60, I'm guessing? You know, he could live a long time. Oh, yeah. What's his life for now?
I think he will virtually have to go into exile. I totally agree with you. I think the more that Prince William, comes to the fore, as he has done now, the more that the focus is on the train wreck that is Harry and Meghan, I think he'll just disappear into the background and, you know, never be heard of again.
And don't you think, had he not been the Queen's favourite son, that the fallout would have been much more massive?
Yes, definitely. Oh, definitely.
She's protected him, hasn't she, the
Queen? Without a shadow of a doubt. You know, seeing him in the royal car with him after he came back from America, after all the scandals and all that kind of stuff. And also, I mean, he should really be in a much more serious position about his own behaviour in terms of how the authorities have reacted to it. I totally agree with you. Unforgivable. Absolutely unforgivable the way he wouldn't disown Jeffrey Epstein. I totally agree. Have you seen that one or two reports coming up? And it'll worry you because you've got daughters as well. So with the COVID, obviously, you go into a pub. I know that you don't use pubs on a regular basis because you are a charming and respectable woman, Leslie Ann. But I go into pubs, you know, if I had a stressful day on the way home, I'd nip into a pub, have a pint or two or whatever. And part of the deal is that you have to either scan an app or you have to fill in details on a piece of paper that you then have to hand behind the bar, because that's track and trace. You know, if somebody in the pub is found to have it, they can alert everybody. But this phenomenon has happened where young ladies doing it, suddenly getting phone calls from the barman. Now, I mean, they should be arrested, shouldn't they?
Well, of course they should, but I can tell you why this is not going to work, track and trace, I mean, because the woke generation say that every time they're asked to give their phone number, they change a digit when they're writing the number down. So track and trace can't possibly work.
Why? Sorry, is this a safety measure so women don't get these nuisance phone calls?
Yes. So they've already worked out how to do that. Right. So I'm not saying I would do this, but they are saying I'm not going to give my whole true telephone number because I don't want these perverts ringing me up.
No, that's true. Well, in that case, it's not going to work. I totally agree. I think that you should have to have proof of identification, because somebody else told me that they went into a pub and, they were listing the names of the people coming in by hand and writing them down. And the guy looked at the book and there were celebrity names there, you know, things like Jeremy Vine, he saw in one book. And so people are just giving any old name. You know, it's like the old Donald Duck syndrome in Fleet Street, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, terribly. Yeah. But what I think they should ask us for is our email address, not our telephone number, because you can always disregard an email if something offensive pops in, or you can forward that to the police if it's really threatening.
Yes.
Whereas a phone call is more difficult to police, if you like. But those barmen or those members of staff should be being reported to the police, and they should also be fired.
Yes, they should be fired. They should be prosecuted. That's harassment on the worst order. And it's harassment taking advantage of a national crisis. And I totally agree. Ms. Jones, I bet you've kept half an eye on the David Bailey diaries, haven't you? They've been published in national newspapers now for the last 3 days. I mean, this is salacious stuff, isn't it?
It really is. And I'm quite, I won't say shocked, but I'm disappointed that, you know, they've said, oh, the memoirs are hilariously un-PC. Yeah. Well, that's not hilarious for a start. What he's really trying to say is that it isn't that I pursued young models. It's just the way we behaved in those days. And I don't think that's good enough.
Yeah. Well, it is the way people behaved in those days, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. But I think he is making light of the fact that he was a sleazebag.
Well, I mean, he was kind of part sleazebag and part heartthrob, wasn't he? He married about three of the most beautiful women in the world, didn't he?
Catherine Deneuve, Marie Helvin. Marie Helvin. Yeah. Yes, I forget the other one now.
Yeah. So I think he was only part sleazebag, really, wasn't he? I mean,
yeah, but he was always a bit dumpy, a bit porky.
Yeah.
Sorry to borrow that phrase.
All right.
He was, bit scruffy, a bit not washed, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure what they saw in him.
But that's what you're supposed to look like in the bohemian Soho 60s when you were racing around town, you know, with a clutch of cameras over your shoulder. It was very glamorous and you were taking pictures of Mick Jagger and Gene Shrimpton and all this kind of stuff, you know what I mean? That was... those cameras, by the way, the long lenses, they remind me of that film Warren Beatty made called Shampoo. Did you ever see that?
Oh, yeah, that's disgusting.
Well, his camera was, in fact, a hairdryer, wasn't it? With an extremely long sort of, sort of nozzle on it. Which...
Enough of long nozzles. I think we've done quite enough of long nozzles in this particular podcast. Telephoto lenses, they were called.
Telephoto lenses, that's right, absolutely right, yeah. But, no, I quite admire Bailey because even though I think he's in his 80s now, or he's certainly getting up towards his 80s, he still seems to have that twinkle in his eye. He's still mischievous and still got an eye for a lady. And I'm just hoping when I get there that I will have all the energy to be just as mischievous. Ms. Jones, just before we go, I've done a couple of radio shows in the last couple of days. I spoke to a landlady of a pub in Liverpool called the Sandon, and it is right next to Anfield, to the, you know, the world famous football ground of Liverpool FC. And I mean, the passion with which she spoke about, you know, the sheer heartbreak of having a pub closed down again in the total lockdown that's been cast upon Merseyside. And do you know what? It wasn't just the fact that there aren't customers coming through the door and she's taking no money and the pub's closed and so on. But she said something very, very poignant. She said, you've got to understand that a pub in Liverpool, particularly next to Anfield, it's not just a pub. She said, it's a daytime home for 40 or 50 people around here who live in these little terraced houses around the ground, who live on their own, whose wives and husbands have gone. And it's almost like a daycare centre for them. And they're bereft and lost because they've got nowhere to go. And she was very angry about the way that the structure of the society around her has been smashed to pieces by COVID.
Yeah, I hear her angst and I don't know what to say to make her feel better. COVID is wide-reaching. It is destroying people's lives. Yeah. And somebody was saying the other day, well, you know, they promised us a vaccine for HIV 30 years ago. We still don't have one. I think partly the reason for that is that HIV affected relatively small percentage of the community worldwide, whereas COVID is affecting 100% of people. Mm. And it is in their best interest to find something that will, you know, help to cure the world. Yeah. I hear their pain, and every day you hear similar stories.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, we haven't got a vaccine for the common cold. We haven't got a vaccine for flu. People say, oh, well, you can get a flu jab. Yes, you can get a flu jab, but the flu jab doesn't guarantee you don't get the flu. It's just, you're hopeful that you might not. I've had flu jabs every year for the last 10 or 15 years. Some years I get a terrible dose of flu and some years I don't, you know. So it's not guaranteed at all. I don't think there'll be a vaccine. What you said about HIV is absolutely right. But remember, because of the particular class of people HIV attack, usually homosexuals, right, there was massive political pressure to find a cure for HIV, and billions and billions of pounds donated by governments and individuals, and they still couldn't find a vaccine. You're so right. And I don't think they'll find a vaccine. They say, oh, you know, the cavalry will come riding over the hill in spring with the new vaccine. There's never been a vaccine invented for a particular illness and that's eradicated it. So I don't think it'll work.
The other thing, of course, is that you tend not to catch flu from other people. You tend to get it because you have a cold or a chill or a cough. You go outside with not enough clothes on. You go from hot to cold environments. You sort of generate it within yourself. It's not so contagious as COVID.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
And until we find a way of doing something about that, and that'll be more social distancing. It'll be more people waking up to how we have to live nowadays. We're never going back to what used to be called normal.
No, I fear you may well be right, or at least it'll be a very long time. You can't fill a football. You can't put people in a football ground, even though it's the biggest open space in most cities, the biggest open air arenas anyway in most cities. I don't understand why I can't put people back in football grounds, but until we do that, we are done. Right, OK, Miss Jones, well, thank you very much indeed for your time today. No doubt you have a busy few days ahead of you, as do I, but it will be a great pleasure to speak to you again very soon.
Yeah, good to hear you, Mike. Have a good week.
Thank you very much. Goodbye, everybody. Bibulous Giggly, prone to fondling, honking, and party tricks, such as standing close to female guests sitting at a table and quietly laying their private part on their shoulder. She didn't use the word private parts either.
What, she said the actual thing, the bit?
The bit beginning with the letter P.
Oh, yes. God, how gross.
She's making out, she's seen that happen, you know, amongst these Etonian...
Well, I bet that's not true. I've never seen anyone do that, and I've been to a few of these dinner parties in my time. I've not seen that. I told you what I did see.
What was that?
Somebody take that out the girl went to the toilet and put it in her glass of champagne.
No. Sorry. Family show.
Family show.
I mean, you know, you're giving me a salacious story now. I'm reading from fact, so I'm excused because it's actual...
Well, it's not really fact, is it? It's a columnist writing whatever she wants to write. So.
It's verbatim from a print. That's what I'm saying.
Okay? Yeah, go on. I'll give you that.
But even reading her promotion for it, it's 83, she's still banging on about sex, you know. And I have to say, I find that little, you know, difficult to sort of feel comfortable with, you know what I mean?
A bit tough to swallow, you mean? Well,
excuse me.
Family.
Another double entendre, honestly.
Shall we do that? Shall we put boob tubes on and go out and see what we can get?
Well, you could put a boob tube on. I would...
So could you.
No, I'd be rather more sophisticated than that.